This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Okay. Hi, welcome to Slot Foundation. My name is Aaron Levy. I'm the executive director and a senior curator here. It's a real pleasure to welcome you, all of you, to Slot Foundation for tonight's program on democracy and disappointment with Alain Badiou and Simon Critchley. Tonight's topic touches upon a long-standing interest of mine, as well as my colleagues here at Slot Foundation, concerning the politics of resistance and the role of artistic and university communities in fostering democracy and dissent. Some of the recent Slot Foundation projects that have addressed these themes include Evasions of Power, a symposium exploring the relationship between literature, architecture, and geopolitics, Cities Without Citizens, an exhibit at and publication with the Rosenbach Museum exploring the conceptualization of citizenship from early America on through to modern times, and The Politics of Mourning, an evening conversation that explored mourning as a generative political process. I invite you to visit our website in the days ahead and to access these recordings. We're particularly grateful for a remarkable collaborative effort to the various individuals and departments in the School of Arts and Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania that have helped make tonight's event possible. These include Roman de la Campa and the Department of Romance Languages, Warren Breckman and the Department of History, David Kazanjian and the Graduate Studies Program in the Department of English, and Rita Copeland and the Program in Comparative Literature and Theory. And all of these individuals are with us here tonight. Additional thanks goes to the Society of Friends of Slot Foundation and Verso, which has generously made possible the display of books in the front. I would also like to express my gratitude to all the amazing volunteers and interns here at Slot Foundation, Colin Cahill, Meredith Rogers, Lucy Steinberg, Becca Starr, Ashley Thompson, Eleonora Raspi, and Chris Bell, without whom programs such as tonight would not be logistically possible. Last but not least, I would like to express a note of personal thanks to the filmmaker Astra Taylor and her colleague Laura Hanna, who's here tonight filming, for introducing the idea of tonight's event to me. We're going to begin tonight's event with a brief presentation by Simon, followed by remarks and a discussion with Alain. Afterwards, we invite those wishing to pose questions to Simon and to Alain to form a line in front of the microphone to my left, where Jean-Michel is, so that everyone in attendance tonight can hear your questions. And now I'm proud to introduce a dear friend and colleague, Jean-Michel Rabaté, a senior curator here at Slot Foundation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and good evening, all of you. It's a pleasure to have you. It's a great pleasure to present tonight's discussion at Slot. Such a meeting corresponds exactly to the idea of critical debates that we've organized in the beginning, that's it, 2002. And it's, on top of that, a great honor for us to be able to bring tonight Alain Badiou and Simon Critchley to engage in this debate. We all look forward to the discussion on democracy and disappointment. Alain Badiou and Simon Critchley are very distinguished thinkers, internationally known philosophers, and I let Roman de la Campa introduced them properly, limiting myself to brief framing remarks. When I said that this discussion corresponds to what we are trying to do at Slot, I'm not only alluding to the prestige and visibility of the authors, nor to the fact that they are about to engage in a friendly, possibly fierce discussion tonight. I mean, above all, that their dialogue fits exactly our sense of what is important for theory today, for philosophy today. And I say that Badiou and Critchley have both contributed to change the scene of theory, the meaning of philosophy. I would take as a significant symptom of this change the coincidence of the publication in 1999 of Simon Critchley's collection Ethics, Politics, Subjectivity, and at the same year the English translation of Alain Badiou's Manifesto for Philosophy. These two books signaled that a new tone was being heard in the world of theory and of continental philosophy. Theory had been under violent attack in the US since the early 90s. It had ossified itself, turning into a systematic and programmatic dismantling of binaries that was supposed to be the death of Platonism. The repetitive and sterile nature of rhetorical exercises in which texts were given the task of exhibiting hidden agencies of hitherto repressed mastery, materiality, femininity, or subalternity, had ended up giving theory a bad name. While using different strategies, referring to different authors, with a little more of Levinas and of Blanchot for Simon Critchley, a little more of Plato, Frege, Cantor, and Lacan for Badiou. Both have insisted on the conditions that are necessary for an affirmative discourse interested in positing truth, stating values, remaining faithful to key events, and above all, engaging directly with burning issues of ethics and politics. On many points, Badiou and Critchley meet, as on the need for humor, the consideration of love as a separate and interesting domain in itself, a radicalized concern for infinity, and they would probably both agree on the centrality of the work of Samuel Beckett. They do diverge on important issues, as one can see in Simon Critchley's recently published Infinitely Demanding, Ethics of Commitment, Politics of Resistance. In this impassioned and provocative book, at one point, Critchley questions Badiou's concept of truth, regrets his exclusion of religion from the conditions for an event, and wonders about his reliance on Lacanian psychoanalysis to define subjectivity. Yet, as we see on the back cover, the first author to endorse Critchley's book is none other than Alain Badiou. Alain Badiou even states that reading and discussing this essay is utterly essential. Perhaps he wanted to stress discussing more than reading. Well, here tonight they are just to do that. I will now call upon Professor Romain de la Campa, well known to many of you, currently chair of the Romance Languages Department at Penn, to introduce them and moderate the debate. In order to be short, I just say that Romain de la Campa is a distinguished scholar of postcolonialism and Latin American discourses, the author of many books on Latin America, especially Cuba, and he shares with Simon Critchley and Alain Badiou one publisher, Verso, with whom he published a collection in 1995, Late Imperial Cultures, and now the forthcoming Split States and Global Imaginaries. Let us all welcome him.
First, I want to thank Aaron and Jean-Michel and the Slot Foundation for launching this effort, this event, and for inviting me to make this brief presentation. I specifically want to thank also the participation, or rather applaud, the participation of English, History, Comparative Literature, and my own department, Romance Languages, in this effort at Penn. I believe that this kind of team effort, this emphasis and this interest in theory in these precarious times in which we live is to be applauded and promises much. So the question would be, of course, who is Alain Badiou and why are we here to listen to him? Is he, as some believe, just the latest French philosopher who's come to save American lit crit? I will argue, or rather briefly state, that this category falls far short. I will also hasten to add that I have much less to say about this topic than Simon Critchley, who is a philosopher, provocative philosopher in his own right, and whose dialogue with our guest of honor will surely be very instructive and enlightening tonight. I could also say very briefly that what many of you can check for yourselves, which is that Badiou is a prominent French philosopher who has published dozens of books, many of which have been translated to English during the last decade. The most widely discussed at this point include Being and Event, Metapolitics, Ethics, an Essay on the Understanding of Evil, and Handbook of Aesthetics, and many more, of course. It should also be noted that Badiou is an accomplished creative writer who has published a number of novels and plays, and that he has been a distinguished professor in the most prestigious French university. So what can I say briefly in my own reading of Badiou? And I will only mention six basic kernels of ideas that continue to inspire me, not as a philosopher, but simply as someone interested in theory as it applies to literary and cultural forms. My first, primary interest is in the fact that Baidu addresses something that I think is in our midst, which is, are we at a point of theoretical exhaustion, or are we indeed at a point of theoretical deficit? I believe that Baidu would assume the latter, but not in a way that does not understand why many people feel the former. And it is this kind of traversing contradictions that I find his work particularly enlightening. Another key element here would be the question of mapping the 20th century. That is, I believe that Baidu engages in this mapping in challenging and at times blasphemous ways as it applies to literature, philosophy, and politics, often with principles that cut across these categories. Most specifically, I believe that Baidu's work seeks ways of engaging these categories of philosophy, literature, and politics in ways that are able to engage to what I would call the twin forces in our habitual thinking, deconstruction and globalization, and the way they happen to crisscross each other in ways that are unbeknownst to many of their proponents. This, of course, implies another element that I believe is central to his work, which is taking on the linguistic turn. He takes it on, but again, not in ways that I believe are knee-jerk reactions or denials, but rather takes on this legacy that comes to us from Saussure all the way through Derrida, this plethora of structuralist and post-structuralist notions and discourses, and engages them in a way that are, in my opinion, less rupture than defiance. Next, I would say that there is another element that I continue to find in Baidu's work very inspiring, which I would call the nominalist conjuration. When you read in his work things like the event, truths, fidelities, there are those who misread them as moralistic returns to concepts of a certain transcendent, shall we say, legacy. But rather, in his case, this is an attempt to combat the element of what we might call linguistic attrition of our times. So he seeks these terms as if to conjure their presence, but a presence that, shall we say, is limited to certain definitions that are within the reach of localities, micro discourses, rather than grandeur and transcendent notions. Two more concepts, and then I will leave you. The one would be literary immanence. In a world in which we continually find ourselves caught in the importance of visual images, the technomediatic powers, Baidu continues to engage in what we would call cultural and artistic forms and the ways in which they can be defined in an immanent fashion. I find it very challenging to understand this concept of immanence, particularly in light of the immanence in our relationship to capitalism and the kind of immanence that, for example, Negri engages in. Lastly, and perhaps the most difficult concept for Baidu's work, has to do with his engagement of mathematics, particularly set theory. I do believe, however, having continued to struggle with it, is that his request that we understand an otherwise rather well-rehearsed term, which is multiplicity, to understand it as something that is grounded not only in the linguistic term, but also in set theory, and therefore perhaps to radicalize the way in which the two can imbue each other, comes across rather distinctly and neatly in his Manual of Inesthetics, where he engages precisely in showing us how poetry and set theory can often come to a point of conjuncture in naming the unnameable. So let us then rejoice, and thank you very much.
So is the, you can hear me? So thank you to the Slot Foundation, and it's nice to be here, and thank you Romy de la Campa, thank you Jean-Michel Rabaté, and thank you Aaron Levy for his creativity and hard work in making this thing happen, and it's a pleasure to, as always, to share a stage with Alain Badiou, and his philosophical friendship is something I treasure and something I continue to learn from. For me, philosophy does not begin in wonder, like Greek philosophy, but in disappointment, with the sense, to quote Wallace Stevens, that a fantastic effort has failed, that the great metaphysical dream of the human being achieving knowledge of itself, of God, and the essence of the soul is just that, a dream. This is the lesson of philosophy in and after Kant. It's a lesson in limitation and the painful process of accepting limitation. We seem to have enormous difficulty in accepting our limitedness and desperately want to believe that the human condition can be overcome, whether through religious salvation, technological salvation, cloning and genetic manipulation, or simply through cryogenics and cosmetic surgery. The inability to accept limitation leads to terrible tragedies. Britney Spears at the MTV Music Awards in September, for example. The point here, to put it slightly differently, is that I think philosophy begins in the experience of failed transcendence, a transcendence that does not lead to any affirmation of immanence, a la Spinoza or Deleuze, but to the question or questionability of transcendence. Fail again, fail better. There are many forms of disappointment, but the two that most interest me and which intersect are religious and political. Religious disappointment opens the question of meaning, namely, that if the legitimating theological structures and religious belief systems in which people like us believed are no longer believable, if, to coin a phrase, God is dead, then what becomes of the question of the meaning of life? So religious disappointment, question of meaning. And this opens the problem of nihilism, a problem that's at the centre of Badiou's work. Nihilism is the breakdown of the order of meaning and the declaration of the meaninglessness of the world. And this can take two dominant forms that I want to mention: active and passive nihilism. Passive nihilism. Rather than acting in the world and trying to transform it, the passive nihilist focuses on himself and his projects for perfecting himself, whether through discovering the inner child, past life regression, writing pessimistic-sounding literary essays, taking up yoga, tantric sex, bird watching, or botany, as was the case with the aged Rousseau. Passive nihilism is the position that Nietzsche called European Buddhism, which shouldn't be confused with genuine Buddhism. He was thinking of Schopenhauer. But along with American Buddhism, I think it's the dominant conformist ideological position today. Active nihilism. It's passive and active nihilism. Like the passive nihilist, the active nihilist also finds everything meaningless. But instead of sitting back and contemplating, the active nihilist tries to destroy this world and bring another into being. I see this as the Promethean radicalism of Leninist Bolshevism, Marinetti's Futurism, De Boer's Situationism, and the rest. At the present time, I think that Al-Qaeda is the highest expression of active nihilism, but I'll come back to that in a moment or two. Just pull my tail in here. My concern tonight is with a second form of disappointment, political disappointment. Here, the sense of something lacking or failing arises from the realization that we inhabit a violently unjust world, a world defined by the horror of war, a world where, as Dostoevsky says, blood is being spilt in the merriest way, as though it were champagne. This situation of injustice provokes the question of justice, namely, what might justice be in a violently unjust world? So political disappointment opens the question of justice. Religious disappointment opens the question of meaning. Those are the two framing issues for me. The experience of political disappointment provokes the problem of ethics, namely, how, given the situation that we're in, how might we motivate an ethical subject to commit to a conception of the good, a conception that might be realised in a politics that faces down disappointment. I think, along with other people, for example, Jay Bernstein, that there is a motivational deficit in contemporary Western societies. The institutions and habits of secular liberal democracy simply do not sufficiently motivate citizens. On the contrary, there's something completely demotivating about those institutions and habits. Some people call this a democratic deficit. In the face of this chaotic and demotivating world, I'm going to move this up a little bit because it's flapping around. Maybe put it over here. Maybe on my t-shirt. I can take my jacket off. There. In the face of this chaotic and demotivating world, divided between the abstraction of rights, democracy, and freedom, and the concrete reality of inequality between sovereign power and new forms of slavery, we either passively withdraw, like the Euro-American Buddhist, or we violently attack, like Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and his friends in London a couple of years ago. The point is that both active and passive nihilists agree on the meaninglessness of reality. My hope is to find what, God forbid, because it sounds Blairite, we might call a third way, an ethics of commitment that might resist both active and passive nihilism and motivate people to acts of political resistance. My basic claim, let's say my meta-ethical claim, by meta-ethics I simply mean that which makes ethics the thing that it is. My basic claim is that at the core of ethics, what I call its existential matrix, is the experience of a demand that I approve. It's in relation to this demand that I begin to shape my ethical subjectivity. The nature of this demand varies in different thinkers. For Plato, it's the demand of the good beyond being. For Paul and Augustine, it's the demand of the resurrected Christ. For Kant, it's the demand of the moral law. For the Marquis de Sade, it's the demand not to give up on one's droit de jouir, the right to orgasm, and so on. I think every thinker, or almost every thinker, has something doing the work of an ethical demand at the core of their views. That's my meta-ethical claim. Although this will sound a little weird, as the normative argument has a lot of ugly scaffolding, and I build it up over some length over a couple of chapters, the ethical subject is defined by a commitment, or in bad use word, a fidelity to a demand that cannot be fulfilled. Commitment or fidelity to a demand that cannot be fulfilled. An infinite demand, a demand that is internalized subjectively, but which divides subjectivity. This infinite demand, and this is the tricky bit, I try and analyze this at some length, makes me the me that I am by dividing me from myself. Makes me the me that I am by dividing me from myself, producing what I call a dividual. An ethical subject is a dividual, defined by the division between the demand to which it responds and its inability to be the equal of that demand. There is a radical experiential excess of demand over approval. Now, moving much too fast, such a divided subjectivity is, I would argue, a way of thinking through the experience of conscience, which is a concept that I want to place back at the heart of ethics and politics. I'm proposing an ethics of discomfort, a hyperbolic ethics based on the internalization of an unfulfillable ethical demand. Such a conscience is not, as Luther would put it, the work of God in the heart of man, but rather the work of ourselves upon ourselves. But I do not understand this work of the self upon itself in, say, Foucault's sense, which always seems to be orientated around practices of self-mastery, what he calls care for the self as a practice of freedom. This is what I would see as Foucault's neo-stoicism. On the contrary, for me, the experience of conscience is that of an essentially divided self, an originally inauthentic, indeed comic self, that can never attain the autarky of self-mastery or authenticity. The flip side of shaping my subjectivity around an infinite ethical demand is finding myself comically ridiculous. In my case, I found this very easy. However, I would urge you to find yourselves comically ridiculous too. The way I can bear both the bleakness of political disappointment and the infinite ethical demand without falling into despair is comically. In laughing or smiling at oneself, in finding oneself ridiculous, there is also an experience of what Freud calls, in his little essay on humour, liberation, elevation. On the morning of his execution, the man who is condemned to be hanged walks out into the prison courtyard, sees the gallows ahead awaiting him, looks up at the sky and says, "Na, die Woche fängt gut an. Well, the week's beginning nicely." This is the essence of humour, a tragicomic, non-delusory, bleak elevation. A tragicomic, non-delusory, bleak elevation. And the political role of humour for me is hugely important. And we need satire, I think, more than ever. We need a sense of the comic in order to cut through the dreadful moralistic sentimentality of American politics, left and right. We need bathos and not pathos. We need a little coolness and coldness. And this is something that we can learn from different sources, one of them, importantly, with the work of Badiou. Something that's often overlooked in his work is its Swiftian character, its satiric character. See, for example, his essays in Polemics and also the recently published book on Sarkozy, De quoi Sarkozy est-il le nom, which has just come out in France. It's very funny. The question then becomes, and it's a classical theme, and I try and address this in the book. This is the question I want to address now, is what's the link between conscience and political action? It's at this point that I want to move from the question of an ethics of commitment to the question of political resistance and what that might mean. I want to lay out three live political options at the present time. The three options are military neoliberalism, neo-Leninism, and neo-anarchism. There might be other options, but let's just start with those three. Military neoliberalism is a term I borrow from the writings of the Retort Group in San Francisco. Military neoliberalism is a faith, and it is a faith. It's a faith in neoliberal economic policy combined with a metaphysical, indeed theological, belief in freedom and human rights. But this is backed up with the threat of military force. In the words of Leslie Nielsen's character from Police Squad, "I'm interested in justice, and that means bullets." We're habituated to the rather nasty version of military neoliberalism that we've seen with Bush Jr. But for all their belated criticisms of the war on terror, things were not and are not so different with the Democratic Party. Clinton was no stranger to bombing. Lest it be forgotten, Barack Obama seems rather keen to bomb northern Pakistan, which I'm sure is a terrific idea. I'm sure Hillary would like to bomb any number of sufficiently powerless countries. So it's not, as it were, just a Republican idea. Military neoliberalism is also a fitting description of Blair's Third Way New Labour project, all mainstream British politics, and a good deal of European politics, the Germany of Angela Merkel and the France of Sarkozy, with some noble exceptions. Let me state categorically and melancholically that I have every reason to believe that military neoliberalism will dominate the future. I very much hope it does not, but the sad lesson of history is that it's usually written by the people with the guns and sticks. And behind everything that I've said and will say, you should hear a profound melancholy about the state of normal politics in the world. In many ways, the most comfortable and plausible response to military neoliberalism is passive nihilism. Just want to bring that category back in. That's to say, in a world that's blowing itself to pieces, in an orgy of inequality, we close our eyes and turn ourselves into an island. Maybe we even say a little prayer at the end of our yoga class and feel some weak spiritual energy connecting everything together as we listen to some tastefully selected ambient music. Indeed, I think that military neoliberalism provokes passive nihilism as a response. I think there's an equation between military neoliberalism and passive nihilism. A retreat from actual politics into individualized activities. Individualized activities that are not even practices of self-perfection, like Richard Rorty, the great pragmatist, insufficiently mourned, I think, in this country. Not even practices of self-perfection like Rorty's private ironist, but largely empty diversions involving intoxication, virtuality, nastiness, and other forms of evasion and escape. In such circumstances, politics is reduced to the function of governmental security and the fantasy of protection from a hostile, alien, and threatening outside world. This is, let's say, a concrete example would be Rudy Giuliani's entire presidential campaign. This is the politics of fear, where the moods of populations are controlled through the fantasy of external, through the external or internal enemy, and the constant threat of attack. This is politics as policing. I think this is, you know, so politics as policing. This would be, let's make up a category, sort of Giulianism. It would be nothing more. And when this becomes the dominant view, then it's not surprising that passive nihilism is the response. In such circumstances, our circumstances, perhaps the best one can hope for is some vaguely globalized, DiCaprio-esque sentimentality about climate change or world peace. So one, as it were, I think, dialectic of the present is a conflict between, as it were, Giulianism and DiCaprioism. That's it. That's between the reduction of politics to pure policing and security and, as it were, the ideological reverse of that being a feeling of global sentimentality around issues of, say, climate change. That's military neoliberalism. The second option I want to talk about is neo-Leninism. I think this is practically expressed in the vanguardism of groups like Al-Qaeda, who would be the best expression of active nihilism at the present time. One should approach Al-Qaeda with the words and actions of bin Laden resonating against those of Lenin, Blanqui, Mao, and Baader-Meinhof. I see jihadist revolutionary Islam as a novel and highly effective continuation of classical forms of revolutionary vanguardism. I'm deeply suspicious of such forms of revolutionary vanguardism, in particular as concerns their use of violence. I'll come to that in a second. As a character in Jean-Luc Godard's Notre Musique puts it, to kill a human being in order to defend an idea is not to defend an idea, it's to kill a human being. Or as subcommandante Marcos of the Zapatistas more eloquently expressed it in a 2003 communique to ETA, the Basque separatist organization, quote, "I shit on all the revolutionary vanguards of this planet," close quote. Leninists and neo-Leninists alike share a dictatorial love of authority and are always what Bakunin would call crypto-Bismarckians. That is, like Zizek, secret statists, whether it's a centralized party state or a caliphate. Neo-Leninism is the political desire for the master, a desire which, in my opinion, must always be frustrated. The third option is neo-anarchism. Let's get a little bit more water, excuse me. Oops. Bring my tail with me. Thank you. neo-anarchism. If one thinks of the sequence of political events that first surged into mainstream media visibility, they go much further back, of course. With the Seattle protest in late 2000, through the massive 2003 anti-war demonstrations, through to the very recent and important demonstrations against the G8 in Germany, there's no question that these and other phenomena indicate that something has decisively shifted in the nature and tactics of resistance. What interests me in the new politics of resistance, which I want to call anarchist, is the activity of the forming of a common front, the horizontal aggregation of a collective will from diverse groups with disparate demands. This is achieved, in the case of these experiences of protest, in a spectacular tactics of protest, the forging of a new language of Thoreauvian civil disobedience, or what we might call nonviolent warfare, where I want to emphasise the words nonviolent. This brings me to an important but moot point. It's a point that Alain and I discussed the other day, the issue of violence. This is something I'm thinking about. If what unites military neoliberalism and neo-Leninism is a commitment to violence, then an opposition to both has to be committed to nonviolence. Full stop. But what does that mean? I want to argue for a nonviolent warfare, as David Graeber puts it, a nonviolence at the limit of violence, but still difficultly pacific. It seems to me that in a world governed by the violence of military neoliberalism, resistance must not take the form of an obvious counter-violence, such as the neo-Leninist logic of Al-Qaeda, but should be devoted to the prosecution and cultivation of, wait for it, peace. This is easily said, I know, but peace is not sheer passivity or a state of rest. It's a process, an activity, a hugely difficult practice. Peace can be warlike without being violent. If military neoliberalism and neo-Leninism are both violent strategies premised upon, the power of the political actor, upon the political actor as a virile, macho, heroic figure, and I have disagreed with Alain Badiou a little recently in the London Review of Books on that question of what I see as a heroism of the decision in his works. That's something we can discuss. If both those strategies, military neoliberalism and neo-Leninism, are committed to a sort of idea of heroism, then what I'm proposing, perhaps oddly, is a politics of powerlessness, where the power of the powerless consists in a refusal of violence and the cultivation of strategies of creative nonviolence. To this extent, I think we still have something to learn from the strategy of nonviolent resistance, or satyagraha, tenaciously prosecuted by that careful reader of Kropotkin and Thoreau, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, and continued by that careful reader of Gandhi, Martin Luther King. Incidentally, when someone like Cornel West calls for deep democracy in the Whitmanesque sense, I hear anarchism. What is anarchism? Anarchism is the theory and practice of directly democratic collective self-organisation and self-determination without the mediation of the state, external law, police and bureaucracy. Odd as it may sound, I think that anarchism, understood as deep democracy at a distance from the state, is the deep political philosophy of the United States. It can be found in Thomas Paine's favouring of society against government and the state. It can be found locally in Priestley and Coleridge's plans for a pantisocracy on the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania, through to the various communist experiments of the 19th century, like the Harmonisted Economy, the wonderful Shakers of Mount Lebanon, and elsewhere. This is what a tradition of what Anton Schutz called the other day, and we were discussing this, pneumatic anarchism. I'm interested in traditions of pneumatic anarchism. And obviously, the Quakers are not that far from my mind in thinking about that. And obviously, in this place, that has a certain historical resonance. What I want to call neo-anarchism, which is perhaps what makes it neo, cannot hope to achieve the classical anarchist dream of society without the state, at least not in present conditions, such as when Bakunin or Kropotkin call for an abolition of the state. Now, although I think that the state, in its alliance with capital, is a limitation on human existence, and we'd be better off without it, and its systems of government, bureaucracy, the police and the military, and while I think that the only legitimate aspiration for politics is federalism, a federation of autonomous communes of the kind imagined by Bakunin or indeed by Gandhi, and not a Leninist centralism, sadly, I do not think that this is an option for most of the Earth's population at this point in time. That's to say, in a time of generalised passive nihilism, when the prospect of social revolution seems rather remote, and the identity of political actors seems a question mark rather than a point of certainty, we're stuck with the state for good or ill. Let's say for ill. And I'd be delighted if someone could prove me wrong on that point. Yet a neo-anarchist politics of resistance can still articulate a politics at a distance from the state, what I call an interstitial distance within and against the state. Resistance is about the articulation of distance, the creation of space or spaces of distance from the state, what the very young Marx, when he was a mere 25, called true democracy in his critique of Hegel's philosophy of the state. Indeed, it's in these terms that I want to describe some of the new social mobilizations, such as the movements for an alternative globalization and the indigenous rights movement. Movements. And let me give a concrete example that I borrow from the work of my colleague at the New School, Courtney Young. Courtney analyzes the rise of the indigenous rights movement in Mexico, and it's illuminating. What the Mexican example shows is the way in which, in the face of the neoliberal policies of the Salinas government in the 1980s and the disarticulation of the traditional oppositional category of peasant, which led to the imprisonment and execution of activists, there was a rearticulation of an oppositional politics on the surface of the state around the category indigenous, which was made possible by something as anodyne as the fact that the Mexican state had been a signatory of an international labour convention. I go into this in much more detail in the book. This then opened the possibility of the creation of a new political actor, the indigenous, and a distance from the state. It also led to the emergence of international activism around indigenous issues, such as the UN Permanent Forum and what's happening, for example, with Morales in Bolivia. Similarly, political activism by Alain Badiou and L'Organisation Politique in Paris around the so-called illegal immigrants, the sans-papiers and the sans-abri, has attempted to create an interstitial distance whose political demand, if one works in France, one is French, invokes the principle of equality at the basis of the French Republic. So, this is the point. One works within the state against the state in a political articulation that attempts to open a space of resistance and opposition. Within the state, against the state. And this is what, if any of you have had the good or bad fortune to read Zizek's critique of my position in the latest London Review of Books, he refuses. I'll maybe come back to this, I maybe won't. For him, it's either state power or no power. That's the contrast. Either state power or no power, and resistance is surrender. Right? And obviously I'm trying to articulate a different position. I see that position. I think there are two main traditions in the left, authoritarianism and anarchism. And it's fairly clear which side I'm on and which side someone like Zizek is on, I think. One hopes, perhaps vainly, going back to that issue of the sans-papiers and the issue of indigeneity, one hopes, perhaps vainly, perhaps not, that something similar to those examples might happen in the US around the politics of immigration, so-called illegal immigrants, which seems to me to be the key political issue of the coming years. Although, you know, we shouldn't get our hopes up about what is going to be done about that. But that would be an example of a new form of political articulation on the model I'm trying to advance. It's always at an intensely situational, indeed local level, that the atomizing, expropriating force of neoliberal globalization is to be met, contested, and resisted. That is, resistance begins by occupying and controlling the terrain upon which one stands, where one lives, works, acts, and thinks. This is deep democracy. It needn't involve millions of people. It needn't even involve thousands. It could involve just a few at first. Resistance can be intimate and can begin in small groups. Revolutions can be quiet. The art of politics consists in weaving such cells of resistance together into a common front, a shared political subjectivity, what Gramsci called the operation of hegemony. What's going to allow for the formation of such a political subjectivity, the hegemonic glue, if you will, is an appeal to universality, whether a demand for political representation, equality of treatment, or whatever. The laughably utopian hope of my approach is that the ethical commitment and demand that I describe, the infinite responsibility that both constitutes and divides my subjectivity, might provide a way of thinking about that hegemonic glue. It might provide something a little sticky. And why do I say that? Well, at the core of neo-anarchism, there is not some spurious belief in scientific socialism or some progressivist philosophy of history, as in some versions of Marxism, but an infinitely demanding ethics of commitment that challenges the vapid mantras of contemporary ideological moralism. One should not, in my view, oppose the moralism of neoliberal human rights and freedom discourse with an anti-ethical position, say, for example, as someone like Chantal Mouffe does, but I think with an intensification of ethical commitment based on a motivated and existentially deepened notion of the ethical subject, an experience of fidelity, even a dimension of prophetic witness. But surely, you might say, anarchism is overwhelmingly concerned with freedom and autonomy and has little to do with hyperbolic infinite demands, conscience and responsibility. My hypothesis or hope is that what differentiates contemporary anarchist practice from its previous 1960s variant turns around the question of freedom versus responsibility. There's no doubt that 1960s anarchism was libertarian and linked to the sexual revolution. Liberation of the erotic instincts, what Marcuse called non-repressive sublimation, or what that celebrated anarchist Alex Comfort called the joy of sex. Yet contemporary anarchism can be seen as a powerful critique of the pseudo-libertarianism of neoliberalism, where the sexual revolution has turned the culture industry into the sex industry. Ask yourself, is there anything today less transgressive and more normalising than pornography? One might say that contemporary anarchism is about responsibility, whether sexual, ecological, or socio-economic. It flows from an experience of conscience about the manifold ways in which the West ravages the rest. It's an ethical outrage at the yawning inequality, impoverishment, and disenfranchisement that's so palpable locally and globally. It's an experience, a visceral experience, of deep democratization, where what motivates political struggle is a shared experience of certain wrongs and a determination to right those wrongs. So what ties together the various groups that make up forms of protest or forms of direct action that we've seen in the last years? What links those together is not some common set of theoretical doctrines, such as Marxism, but rather a shared sense of grievance and wrong, namely that things like unrestrained multinational corporate military neoliberalism is wrong, that war is the wrong response to the grief of 9/11, etc., etc. These are often sort of vague sentiments. It's also interesting to me. Strange as it may sound, perhaps contemporary anarchism is closer to someone like Immanuel Levinas than someone like Herbert Marcuse. an anarchism of the heteronomous other rather than the autonomous self. It's an anarchism of the other human being, an anarchism that, at the subjective level, deracinates my autarky, my autonomy, my self-sufficiency, my self-satisfaction, and opens me to the other's infinite demand. Obviously, the ultimate goal of politics has to be autonomy, understood as collective self-legislation and self-management. But this requires the acknowledgement of a heteronomous moment in the constitution of autonomy, the experience of what I call heteroaffectivity, or an unfulfillable, infinite ethical demand, bearing witness to the event. And I'm going to finish right there. Thank you very much for listening.
Simon has three characteristics. It's as clear as the pure water of a source. It's as affirmative or conclusive as a love's declaration. And it's as subtle and rigorous as a scientific word. It's this mixture of transparency, of conviction, and of rigor, which makes so profound and seductive the reading of Infinitely Demanding. If you take in account the English humor, you have the delicious and original philosophical style of Simon Christie. My proper reading will be a sort of rumble in Simon's prose garden. I shall select one sentence in each chapter of the book. You have on the paper the six sentences. It will be as we can select a rose in the marvelous unfolding of a park. Maybe okay. Maybe sometimes I shall just put in a rose a very small piece of poison. First, at the very beginning of the introduction, page one, we find an example, a clear example of the descriptive dimension of the book, of the experimental style of Simon. Something like a very concrete approach of a problem. We seem to have enormous difficulty in accepting
our limitedness, our finiteness, and this failure is a cause of much tragedy. In this sentence, we find a first very important consequence of the fact that for Simon, the beginning of philosophy, and maybe the beginning of true thinking in general, is disappointment. Disappointment to our proper appropriation, precisely, to our limitedness, our finiteness. We cannot accept, in fact, the world as it is. And is this refusal of the world as it is, which is the beginning of ethics. I agree perfectly with this point, Simon. There is in fact something in the disappointment which is essential. But the problem is the relationship between the negative dimension of disappointment and the affirmative dimension of infinitely demanding. Yes, we have enormous difficulty in accepting our limitedness and so on. But if there exists something like the possibility of infinite demand, there is something infinite in human nature. And maybe the problem sometimes is not at all to accept the finitude, but to accept our infinite dimension. So, if I have to say precisely the point of discussion between Simon and me on this point, it's a question of a tension inside the subject, inside the individual, between finite and infinite, between disappointment and demand. I know that for Simon, the subject is divided precisely by this situation. But the question of the becoming of this division is a very complex one. We can say that in another manner. Yes, we have much tragedy because our non-recognition of our finitude. But we have also another sort of tragedy, which is our inability to recognize our infinity, to recognize not only the infinite demand, but the possibility of something infinite in the human creation. And so I only propose to say, it's not really a piece of poison, to complete the proposition, this first proposition, by saying that there is two different sorts of tragedies. The refusal of finitude, but also the refusal of the infinite. Second point, in the chapter one, the second sentence, it's an example of the declarative, of axiomatic style of Simon, axiomatic dimension of the book, when it's not a description, but a principle, and with a touch of abstract violence. You know, Simon is against violence. But maybe there is something in him which is sometimes violent. It's false, Simon. And we can read in the book itself something like that. Without the experience of a demand to which I am prepared to bind myself, to commit myself, the whole business of morality would either not get started or would be a new manipulation of ante formula. I don't know who is the victim of your violence here. Who manipulates ante formula? The question, this time, is the question of experience, which is really a very important word in the Simon's book. Philosophy begins by an experience, the experience of disappointment. But ethics begins also by an experience, the experience of demand, of infinite demand. My problem is that in any case, we presuppose the existence of a subject of this experience. Without the experience of a demand to which I am prepared to bind myself, I, to commit myself. And it's the difficulty of the word prepared. I am prepared to bind myself, to commit myself. In the context of the book of Simon, I think, or I propose to say, that there is finally a confusion, but confusion deliberate, it's not a fault, between individual and subject. And probably it is the most important discussion between us. I think that certainly the subject of the experience of disappointment is the individual, the subject of the negative experience. But is the subject of infinite demand the individual? Is it the same subject? That is really a question. I propose to say that probably the subject of ethics is the result of the demand and not its support. And so we have to distinguish between the subject of the demand and the subject of, for example, the experience of disappointment. And maybe the most appropriate distinction is the distinction between individual, empirical subjectivity, if you want, and something else. But maybe ethics is not an experience in the same sense, because in the experience of ethics, the question is that an individual must become a subject. Point three, if what it means, it's a question of truth. I have to speak of all that because there is a discussion, an explicit discussion with me in the book of Simon. Discussion of my vision, page 42 to 49, in chapter 2. And it's certainly a very clear and very striking reading of my Saint Paul. And it's, I think, the most organized reading of my Saint Paul, very systematic and clear. But I cannot agree, naturally, with the idea that we can suppress the word truth and choose the word justification. You see the problem. Simon writes, if what is mean by truth is the procedure by which norms are justified, as I think it has to be, then I think it will be better to speak of justification rather than truth, at least in the realm of ethics. You have here the third style of Simon. I have to call the style of description, the phenomenological style, of the violent style of affirmation, the axiomatic style, and here you have the style when he acutely criticizes a notion. So the style of critics in Simon. What is the point? And why I cannot agree for the substitution of justification to truth? I cannot agree at all. First, truth is not the procedure by which norms are justified. Ontologically, I shall return to the question of ontology at the end of my discussion. Ontologically, the truth is the construction of something new. The truth is not a judgment, nor a justification. A truth is a construction of a new multiplicity in a concrete world. A truth is a creation, artistic creation, political creation, scientific creation, and so on. A truth is always the process of the construction of something new in the world. And there is a formal and very precise concept of what is a truth. This new multiplicity, this novelty in the world, is a generic subset. Technically, it's the generic subset. There is a genericity of the truth. It's a multiplicity, if you want, without qualitative determination, which is not particular, which is universal in some sense. And we can give to this concept of truth a completely precise definition. There is also a logical definition of what is a truth. A truth is the set of consequences of a perturbation, of disturbance, in the organization of appearing, in the organization of the world. Particularly, a truth is a set of consequences of the fact that something which before the event exists in the world in the minimal sense of existence, becomes existence in a strong sense. A truth is always something in relationship with the modification of the intensity of existence of something in the world. If you want, the sublimation of something which was like an inexistent of the world. So, I refute absolutely the neo-scepticism of Simon. When, with Wittgenstein, he says, I quote, that truth is just a way of talking. It's bad. So, it's the first point. You can say after that there is no relationship between ethics and truth. You know the point. But we cannot transform the definition of the truth, and after that, saying that truth is nothing at all, we can say justification. So, Simon, you have the duty to criticize really my definition of the truth. Okay. and not by Wittgenstein means. But but as an effect of all that, as an effect of the fact that somehow the technique. It's not a truth. as an effect of all that, it's clear that for me, it, at the end of the sentence of the Rose 3, it's better to speak of justification rather than truth, at least in the realm of ethics. It's clear that for me, there is nothing like a realm of ethics. There are only singular situations where a truth proceeds or exists. And all commitment, for me, is strictly relative to this particular process. And so there is no sense for me, but that is a discussion, to speak of a realm of ethics. Mm-hmm. We have only singular situations when perhaps we have something like the process of a truth, and we have the question of ethics relatively to this process. But in an abstract manner, we cannot define the question of ethics apart of the singularity of a situation. In chapter 3, and it's the quotation 4, in chapter 3, we find a very original and subtle opposition between an heroic vision of ethics and a new way of sublimation by humor. It's a very nice part of the book and completely original. The idea that there is a comic sublimation of ethics, which finally protects the subjectivity much more than the heroic vision, and which is the possibility to distinguish between the ethical process and something finally like being for death. I completely agree with Simon in the line of Adorno of Gunther Grass concerning the critique of the Heideggerian pathos of authenticity. But my question is, it's really a question for you. There is, in fact, no close relationship between heroism and authenticity. Certainly, in the Heideggerian framework and some other framework, we have this relationship. But it's not a necessity. We can perfectly define an heroism without any notion of authenticity, return to the true origin, and so on. We can have an heroism of the void, an heroism precisely of the becoming subject in a concrete situation. I define heroism as the possibility for an individual to become a subject. It's my only strict definition of heroism. We exist as individuals. We exist, finally, as something like human animals. And in some circumstances, we have the chance to become subjects. And there is some heroism, not at all because it's much more authentic to be a subject than to be an individual. There is nothing like that. But simply because the becoming subject is to go beyond
the proper limits of our existence as individuals.
And this point is linked to another point. You sometimes say, and it's the case in this sentence, I would argue that humor recalls us to the modesty and limitness of the human condition. Okay. But modesty, I don't like really this word, because it can be absolutely a word of the state. Be modest, my friends. Stay at your place. Yeah. Don't have illusions. Mm-hmm. Don't do something great. Okay. So modesty is also the possibility of something very oppressive. Mm-hmm. And it's generally the point of view of the state to desire the general modesty. So it's a real problem concerning the word modesty. I think it's a necessity to divide this word. There is two different modesties. There is the modesty of knowledge, of appreciation of the real situation, the modesty of what is possible in some situations and so on, okay. But there is a negative modesty, which finally is only the imperative, be quiet. Be quiet, be at your place, don't move. And I think it's in relation, all that is in relationship with precisely the distinction between individual and subject. Because modesty can signify the desire to stay in the individual condition, to don't become a sujet, a subject. And so maybe concerning modesty, you pay the price of the indistinction between individual and subject. Because if, in fact, you cannot decide between individual and subject, modesty becomes a very difficult word in the realm of ethics, which don't exist. And in chapter 4, which is a magnificent chapter concerning anarchic metapolitics, it's a complex and precise discussion with the Marxist legacy, with the modern theories of emancipatory politics, Negri, Laclau, and others. And it's I don't know an other text which is so clear and so complete concerning, finally, the situation today of metapolitics, in fact, of general metapolitics. Really, I have a great admiration for all the beginning of this chapter. And the central concept is true democracy. True democracy. Why not? Why not true democracy? If democracy can be true. My question would be the question of the means, of the real, of the body of true democracy, something like that. How true democracy can be something else than an idea. The politic disappointment, I read the Rose 5. The political disappointment provokes an experience of injustice
and the feeling of anger. I think anger is very important, and contrary to the classical tradition, to the Stoic tradition, in fact, in Seneca, say, I think that it is the first political emotion. It is often anger that moves the subject to action. Anger is the emotion that produces motion, the mood that moves the subject. But such anger at the multiple injustices and wrongs of the prison provokes an ethical response. Okay. My problem is that that sort of beginning is a negative one. The sense of injustice, the revolt against the wrong of the world, and so on. Feeling of anger, okay. But in fact, I think that all that cannot create a new political subject. That is my difficulty. I think that we can have, naturally, negative feelings, negative experience concerning injustice, concerning horrors in the world, and so on, war, terrible wars. Okay. But I don't think that all that is the creative part of a new political subject. All great movements in the political historical field has been created, has been provoked, not by that sort of negative feeling, but always by a local victory. And it's from the very beginning. If we appreciate, for example, why we have during 2 years the great revolt of the slaves in the Roman Empire under the direction of Spartacus, you know that. It's not because slaves have the feeling of injustice and so on, because they have always. They have always, naturally. It's their experience day after day. It's because in one small place, a small group of slaves find new means, finally, to to create a victory, a small victory, a local victory. And after that, under the effect of enthusiasm, of affirmation, of the possibility of something new, we have the creation of a new subjectivity at the general level. And it's the same thing, to take a completely different example, for May 68 in France. May 68 was not provoked by a feeling of injustice concerning universities and so on. Finally, it has been a small victory, which has been, at a precise moment, the decision of the government to retire the police of the Sorbonne. And it has been an extraordinary feeling of victory. It was the first time that the power on a precise point was on the defensive. And so, I say all that because I think that we cannot put all the political process in the limits of negative affects. And it's a logical problem to the great problem of relationship between negativity and affirmation in the political creation. But I think that always the creation of a new subject, precisely, that is, of something which go beyond the individual as they are, is of a victorious nature and not of negative passion. And it is what I name the power of affirmation or the positive dialectics. I think that All that, maybe it's the last consequences for you, Simon, of the influence of Levinas. I quote, it's the last quotation, at the core of such a neo-anarchism, there is not an ontology, nor an economic theodicy, but an infinitely demanded ethics of commitment that challenge the vapid mantra of contemporary ideological moralism. Yes, but you stay in the opposition of ontology and ethics. Mm-hmm. And that is the great idea of Levinas. But after all, it's not sure that there is an opposition between ontology and ethics. It's not sure. Because there is a clear opposition between ethics and ontology if ethics begins by an individual experience. Okay, if it is really an individual experience, we can say that this individual experience is not reducible to ontological considerations. I agree with that. But if the beginning of ethics is in a concrete situation under the condition of the construction of a truth, the becoming subject of an individual is not the same framework. Because the becoming subject of an individual under the condition of the process of a truth, and finally under the commitment to an event, is of ontological nature in one sense. Because it's something, an event, which is a rupture in the order of being as such. And so the ethics of the situation, the ethics of the truth, depends on something which is not reducible to the experience of the individual, but which is precisely beyond all possible experience of the individual, because it's a rupture in the becoming of being as such in the situation. And so, probably our final but very big discussion would be on two points I propose to say. First, the distinction, or the not distinction, or the distinction between individual and subject, and the context, the general context, which is the opposition between ethics as fundamental experience, for example, experience of the other, and ontology, included ontology of the event. Thank you.
Not too much poison.
No, not so much poison.
Bon, allez.
What should we do now?
Either you can continue the discussion between yourselves,
yeah,
or we can open
okay.
Up.
How long will
it take? 20, 25 minutes?
Yeah, I'll be really quick. Because people want to speak. I need to think carefully about these 6 points, and I will do so at my leisure and try and write something that begins to be plausible. I mean, the other thing about writing books, as many of you will know who've written books here, is that they often have traces of corpses and forms of life that you no longer inhabit. I think there's, in many ways, one aspect of the difference here is the difference of my relation and your relation to the Copernican turn. And much of what I say in the book comes from a certain, if you like, dogmatism about the Copernican turn, which I'm beginning to feel less dogmatic about, in the sense in which the idea of accepting our limitedness, our finiteness, this would be a way of saying, well, this is the position of philosophy after Kant, and either one accepts the Copernican turn or one doesn't, and it's at that point sheep and goats, and one's either a sheep or a goat. And there's a residual Kantianism in the distinction between, in particularly in the area three, where I'm talking about truth as a procedure whereby norms are justified, and a realm of ethics versus a realm of knowledge. So I'm inclined to map Alan's dualistic ontology onto a Kantian dualism, which then leads to certain perverse results. And I accept that that's something to be thought about. Also runs together with the idea of modesty. You know, I agree, modesty can be oppressive. In many ways, I'm a recovering Heideggerian in the sense in which, for me, I was taught by French Heideggerians and I still bear the scars. And the sense in which, you know, for me, when you're talking about heroism and authenticity, for me there's an identification of heroism and authenticity in the sense in which what I see is at the core of the early Heidegger's project is an idea of autarkia, an idea of, you know, self-sufficiency. And so the idea of a heroics of the void is a conception which, in a sense, doesn't fit in that model, but that could and should be loosened up. So, going back to the Copernican turn, this would be the issue of, you know, the meaning of infinity. I mean, in a sense that to accept the Copernican turn is to accept, in a sense, the axiom of finitude. And then one does philosophy in the consequence of that. Infinity then comes back into the picture, for me, as a social experience. It's infinity as a social or a phenomenological experience where it comes back in. The relationship between that notion of infinity and there being something infinite in human nature is something else. And I can feel bits of the architecture of my approach creaking at that point. I need to think harder about that. The issue of anger and whether true democracy in the way I use it, and obviously I'm using that term, borrowing that term from the early Marx, whether that in a sense, is whether there is an absence of a power of affirmation at one level, and whether it, the issue of how one would embody that that notion of true democracy. I mean, what I was trying to do in some of the examples in the talk and some of the examples in the book is to, on the one hand, point to certain examples like, you know, the indigenous movements or the sans-papiers, sans-abri in the Parisian context, and to both operate descriptively and to make certain normative claims on that basis. The idea that politics has to begin from a local victory, I completely agree. In many ways, we were talking about this the other day. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many ways, the entirety of politics on the left is the interpretation of the fact of the commune. Mm-hmm.
of the Paris Commune of 1871 and what one does with that fact. And I'm reading State and Revolution again just for the, because it's different things in my head. And, you know, it's who gets to speak in relationship to the fact of the Commune? The anarchists, the Leninists, or someone else? So the relationship between individual and subject and ethics to ontology, for me, and this is something I've learned from you, I mean, but I don't think it's as clear as it should be. If I think about the logic of the subject in your work, which I think is clearest in the book on Paul, it becomes, what you see there is an equiprimordiality of subject and event. Right? So the subject comes into existence through the experience of an event. Grace binds itself to that event in conviction, faith, works with that faith in love, and that becomes then politically articulable in the experience of hope. So those four moments of grace, faith, love, and hope, which I see as the sort of the axiomatics of the event in the book on Paul. I simply want to echo that in the sense in which the experience of the ethical demand, of the infinite ethical demand, is that moment when the subject becomes a subject through its submission to a demand which it cannot fulfill. The experience of a demand. So, to that extent, the core of what I'm arguing for in the book, this idea of ethical experience and ethical subjectivity, is this idea of the transformation, conversion of the self in relationship to an event which at the same time creates a subject. And there's more that I want to add to that. I mean, the difference would then be that, let me put it this way. And this maybe takes us to ethics and ontology, and maybe takes us to a discussion about Levinas, and maybe also a discussion with psychoanalysis. I think in your work there is a structural Christianity. A structural Christianity, not a commitment to, you know, any metaphysical entities, in the sense in which it's about that Pauline experience of conversion, where subject and event, a subject comes into existence through an event, and where Saul becomes Paul. The position I'm, I suppose, advancing is more structurally Judaic, in the sense in which it's about the transformation of a subject in relationship to an event, mm-hmm. but what that articulates is an anteriority, right? Or a relationship to the fact of the law, or a relationship to the anteriority of the unconscious, or something like that. And that would mean that the idea of an infinite demand there is a... is the submission of a self to an experience of an event which is incomplete at both ends. It's infinite in the sense in which it exceeds my experience, as it were, socially, and it comes from an experience of anteriority, the past, which I cannot... So for me, let me put it this way. I think that there is, in your work, a fascinating reaffirmation of the present. Right, the experience of the present. And I suppose the position I'm arguing for wants to introduce moments of the immemorial past and the radical future into that experience of the present. And that might be a difference, and that might be a place where we could discuss. And the last point I make, ontology is a... I mean, I'm worried about ontology for two sets of reasons. I'm worried about ontology for, let's say, Levinasian reasons, which are sort of that you know, we needn't necessarily worry about. I'm worried about ontology because I think the what worries me is the idea of the political subject being based in some fact or some state of affairs. And what worries me there is for example, is negri, is sort of forms of multitude talk, in a sense that the if you think about the arguments of a book like Empire and elsewhere in Negri, we have a sort of systemic holism. There is one, this is the Spinozist moment, there is one substance and there are different modes of that substance, different attributes of that substance, one as multitude, one as empire. But in a sense, the subject is something that one already is at the ontological level. It's just a question of finding modes of articulation for that. I have a more agnostic view of the ontological domain, and in terms of politics, the other figure who you didn't mention who's hugely important to me is Gramsci. And Gramsci's constructivist idea of political subjectivity and is what I see as a suspicion about forms of ontology. But those are claims about sort of substantive, maybe old, you know, substantive metaphysical ideas of ontology. When you're talking about ontology as the, you know, a rupture in the state of being to become a subject is an ontological act. I accept that, but I think it's a different meaning of the idea of ontology than the one I'm working with. But thank you.
Two small questions. Poison, naturally.
Poison.
Do you think, finally, that the individual is structurally good?
Structurally?
Good. I say that because it seems to me that if the individual is structurally able to have the experience of infinitely demanding and commitment, it's finally something like an ontological determination of this individual.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it's not from outside that something is coming to transform the individual into a subject, it's because there is something in the structure of the individual itself which is appropriate to infinitely demanding. And it is why I think that you have said sometimes that I am a Rousseauist.
Yes.
But I think you are a Rousseauist. Because you are thinking that individual is good, finally. There is some... I don't think so. I think the individual is not good, nor bad. Mm-hmm. I think the individual is something like a human animal, which is, as Nietzsche says, indifferent, finally, to the good and and the evil.
Yeah.
And so, it's my first question.
Yeah.
Is there, in your vision, the idea of something which is potentially good in every individual? And my second question, which is the same, in fact, concerning finitude or finiteness, we have to respect, to accept our finitude. Okay. But it's because finitude, in your vision, is an ontological determination of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
I see no other reason. It's because it's true that we are finite. And so it seems to me that You say on one side that ethics begins by a pure experience of something like something open, finally, something which is infinitely open in the mind. But you have two very strong ontological axioms. First, the individual is structurally able to be a good man or a good woman. And individual as such, because there is no distinction between individual and a subject. It's not from outside that something is coming. In my conviction, it's always from outside. Mm-hmm. We are forced to be good. It's not at all a natural position. And second, our finitude that we have to accept in a moderate fashion is also an ontological determination of the subject. And the ethical experience in under these two very strong conditions, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think the axiom of finitude, as we're saying, would be, you know, that would be an ontological, it would be a truth. Mm-hmm. we are the sort of beings that die. Mm-hmm. And it's that moving limit of finitude in relationship to which we make sense of ourselves. Is, on the formal point, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think I'm committed to an idea of the individual as essentially good in the Rousseauist manner. What I want to argue for, and maybe I'm self-deceived about this, I mean, I accept that possibility entirely, is that ethical experience is such that formally, that one is there is a being who is able to be the subject of a demand and to transform themselves into a subject. Is that because they're is that something which happens to all subjects or to all individuals? No, I don't think it is. It's something which you'd say certain individuals in certain conditions are capable of. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say that the possibility of an ethical subject is based on some anthropological datum of the individual as essentially good in the manner of a Rousseau. Mm-hmm. But I...
Yeah, but I just say my proper vision on this point. I think that individual as such has no ability to go beyond its limits, in fact. It perfectly knows that it is a limited animal. And what creates for the individual a new possibility is only something which is outside the individual mm-hmm. itself. Okay, I name that an event. We can discuss for you sometimes is otherness, heterogeneity, something like that.
Yeah, or
so we agree. Yeah. In one sense, we agree on this point. Yeah. For the creation of a new possibility for the individual cannot come from inside the individual purely. Mm-hmm. So there is something which is outside. There is a potency of the outside.
Yeah.
But what creates the event or the other a love encounter or something like that? What is created is a new possibility. Eh? And you name that a demand, finally. There is a new possibility. It's very important to understand that the event don't create a new subject as such. It creates a new possibility for individuals. And this new possibility is beyond the limits of the individual. Naturally, it is the reason for which it's a new possibility. If it had been something which is inside the limits of the individual, it would not be a new possibility. So we have the creation of a new possibility, which is, in fact, beyond the limits of the individual. It is why I am very suspicious concerning the respect of our limits and so on. Because a new possibility is always something precisely is beyond that sort of limits. Yeah? And sometimes beyond, in fact, for example, the fear of death. And it is why there is something like heroism in some circumstances. It is because the fear of death, which is the direct experience of our limits, we can go beyond the fear of death in some circumstances of resistance and so on. And so it's the beginning of the transformation of the individual into a subject. Because for this transformation, by necessity, we must have something which is beyond the limits of the individual. And it is why I think that if you say only, you speak only of the general realm of ethics and on infinitely demanding and so on, there is an ambiguity, because the function of something which is outside, first. And second, the creation of a possibility which is beyond the limits of the individual are for part unclear. Mm-hmm. All these two points, in my conviction, are very important. Mm-hmm. And with these two points, I think we cannot escape completely to an heroic vision.
Yeah.
If we speak of something heroic, when precisely the individual is sized in a new possibility which is beyond its proper limits. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can treat that as with comedy too.
Yes. The
possibility.
Yeah.
It's another discussion, because I appreciate all your development concerning humor, comic, and so on. But the point is the relationship between the individual, the question of the limits of the individual, the potency of something which happens outside the individual, and the opening of something which is beyond the limits, as precisely the beginning, the possible beginning of a new subject which is composed with individual, naturally. There is nothing else than individual. It's composed with individual, but which is also beyond the limits of individuality.
Simon, I hate to do this, but I think that this might be a great point to end at, since I have to get you back to the train station. But do you want to make any last comments? Or
do you want to open it up?
Two quick questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
Sure.
I noticed that you insistently equated the individual with what you call the human animal, right? In there, you seem to trace a strict discontinuity between humanity and animality, right? The question would be what you're trying to do. And the second one, it's hard for me not to think, if not to wonder, where, if that happens, if this discontinuity happens, where in evolutionary history would this happen? If that question makes sense.
Dans l'histoire évolutionnaire.
Oui. The question for me is not, in fact, the question of the division, of the distinction between humanity and animality. For me, after all, mankind, human being, is an animal. nothing else. It's a special animal. And I prefer to name that individual, a human animal, individual, as you want. It's a special animal because it's precisely in situation to be forced by something outside, by an event, to have a new possibility which is beyond the classical limits of its individuality. Maybe something like that is also possible for other animals. I don't know. We don't know. Mm-hmm. We don't know because we know very few things concerning animals, in fact. Maybe we are very near animals, or animals are very near us. We don't know, really. So I speak of what I know, and I know that in history, in concrete example, and so on, we know that it's possible for a human being to do the experience of the opening of something new in the field of possibilities and something which go beyond its ordinary limits and, for example, which go beyond the fear of death, which go beyond what it considered generally like forms in artistical creation. There is new possibility concerning what is a form, new possibility concerning science, and so on. And so it's I cannot have a metaphysical debate concerning the difference between animal and humanity. I don't know. It's not, in fact, my problem. When I speak of a human animal, it's not a negative consideration. It's always an objective one. We are animals in general. And so it is why the question of truth, the question of new political process, the question of artistical creation, and so on, are questions which are difficult. And naturally, the human life is absolutely not reduced to the question of truth. The question of truth is sometimes I say, maybe it's not a chance to encounter truth. We are quite without truths, in fact. We are quite animals, in a good sense. But sometimes something happens which produces in the field of our activities the chance, or the bad chance, maybe, of a new possibility which is beyond our limits. And concerning revolutionary facts, mm-hmm. when there is an event in revolutionary form, it's always we can see the constitution of a new political subject. It's clear, and it's not. There is no circumstance where we can see that revolution is the result of the constitution of a new political subject. It has been always the reverse. The event as such, which has been prepared and so on, but it's the event as such which creates the new political subject. For example, before the revolution of 1917, the Leninist concept of the party was an abstract one. It was a small group. It was near nothing. Mm-hmm. The great conception of the party was the German social democracy. For Lenin himself, it was like that. But after the revolution, because the revolution has solved some problems, we have the beginning of a new political subjectivity along all the last century. And what is, I think we have to understand the complete articulation between ordinary life of mankind, human animals, and so on, the question of the rupture and of the event, and the construction of the subject of a truth, which is under the condition, the external condition of the event, but which is a construction in the situation. And in fact, my difference with Simon is is very small, because I think that what Simon says in general has to be replaced in the field of the constitution of a truth. So I don't believe that there exists something like a general or abstract ethical commitment. But when we are in the condition which is created by an event and the fidelity to the event, the constitution of a new subject and so on, all is practically as you say that it is. Mm. But I think there is conditions for your proposition, and I think it's difficult to propose all that as a characteristic of a human being as such.
Mm. I think we should.
So there is something to consume, finally.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, we have to end here, but I want to extend an enormous thank you to both of you, Simon and Alain, on behalf of all of us.